This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Roger McNamee was an early investor in Facebook. Now he's the author of a book called Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. So give us the quick sketch of why you seem to have turned on the company you invested in.
So, Dave, imagine this. I spent 34 years investing in Silicon Valley. I was there from the earliest days of the personal computer industry. I was a true believer. And when I met Mark Zuckerberg in 2006, he was 22. Facebook was a brand new company. He was 2 years old. And, you know, I did some things to help Mark be successful, helped to introduce him to Sheryl Sandberg. I really, really believed in Facebook. In 2016, long after I had ceased to be active there, in fact, after I'd retired from the investment business, I happened to see some things going on over the course of that year that not only didn't fit my rosy, lovely view of Facebook, but in fact scared me because they related to bad actors using the advertising tools of Facebook to harm innocent people. So I reached out to Mark and to Sheryl Sandberg in the fall of 2016 to alert my friends. They weren't interested. I spent 3 months begging with them to just take this seriously and recognize that as a really successful company, they had a responsibility to the people that used their product. But they weren't interested, and as a result, I realized I needed to go out and alert the world that there were issues with companies that I had been involved in that I loved, but where there was a real threat to democracy, to public health, to privacy, and frankly, to the economy.
Did you give the heads up in time for them to have done something or not?
Well, to be clear, it depends on what you call by in time to do something. I don't think there was any way to stop what was going on from the Russians or from Bannon in the 2016 election. But I gave them lots of warning for cooperating with investigators, for protecting future elections, for taking care of some of the other issues that came up. If you think about the privacy issues relative to Cambridge Analytica and all that came after that, if you think about some of the issues that have happened since then, there was time for them to get ahead of the issue, to go to the aid of the people who use the product, to change the business model.
What was Mark Zuckerberg's attitude? Was it, don't be silly, this isn't happening? Or was it, look, this is how we make money?
No. To be clear, both Mark and Sheryl reached back out to me very quickly. They were very responsive. But they said, no, Roger, there's nothing wrong with the product. There's nothing wrong with our algorithms or our business model. Everything that you saw was isolated, and we've already taken care of it. Now, one of the things that I saw was the original Department of Housing and Urban Development citing Facebook for advertising tools that allowed discrimination in housing in violation of the Fair Housing Act. Now, you may have seen earlier this week, HUD has sued Facebook because they still haven't fixed that problem. And, I mean, Dave, you never know how the future would have been, how the world would have turned out if something different had happened. But I would like to believe that they would not be on the defensive today and that they wouldn't have lost so much trust. And to be clear, this isn't just about Facebook. It's really about a culture in Silicon Valley and a culture in the economy where essentially data is being used in ways that are harmful to consumers. And, you know, I don't think it's because people are bad. I think it's because we've had a period of time without any rules. And, you know, smart, clever people have grabbed business opportunities where there was no one to say no. And now we're in this situation where there are a lot of things going on, and Facebook is by no means the only perpetrator of this. A lot of things going on that, you know, realistically, when people understand the details, they're going to go, wait a minute, that shouldn't be. I mean, why is it that our credit card information is freely traded in a third-party market? Why can people trade our location and our health data that comes out of applications and our, you know, internet browsing history? Why can they even collect data on children? I mean, there are all kinds of things, like questions like that, that have never been asked. And once people ask them, they realize, no, none of those things should be going on. And yet they're pervasive.
But that's what makes Facebook such a hot commodity. The reason there's discrimination on Facebook is because of the data being so specific. You can divide people by race, income, zip code, personal characteristics, hair color if you want. And if Zuckerberg were to abandon that, then he'd just be another broadcaster, you know, like us.
And to be clear, there's a reason why there are limits on broadcasters, right? Because we realize socially that there are problems if, you know, for example, if shows are on in real time and somebody uses the wrong language or says the wrong thing, that's actually socially undesirable outcome. And I think we're going to go through a period of time now, Dave, where we're going to realize with internet platforms that it isn't all puppies and family photographs. There's a lot of other things that can go on. You can get New Zealand, you know, where we had a terrorist who killed 50 people.
So you think they should be regulated like broadcasters are?
I'm saying we need to have a conversation about what the limits ought to be. And that's really I'm not qualified to tell you every single thing that should happen from a regulatory point of view, but I do think we need to create space for competition to happen. And I think we do need to have limits on what can be done with people's personal data, because at the moment they have no control over things that really represent like a data avatar and which can be used to, without their knowledge, to have a huge influence on their behavior.
Isn't the cat out of the bag, though? You say people have no control. If, after all we've learned in the last 2 years, people are still on Facebook sharing details of their lives, that's on them, isn't it?
No, to be clear, Dave, I'm not worried about people sharing details of their lives. That's not the data we're talking about. I'm talking about the fact that when you use your credit card, that data can be traded by the credit card processors, the banks, to other people who want to know great detail about you. I'm talking about the fact that your cellular phone company or Uber or Lyft can trade your location history, that pretty much any website can trade your browsing history, that if you have a health or wellness app, they can trade very intimate health data. And you're not even aware of this stuff. It has absolutely nothing to do with, to me, if people want to put stuff on Facebook or Instagram or YouTube, you know, God bless. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about here is all the other stuff. I mean, all the focus has been on the stuff people put into the products, but that's like 1% of the issue. You know, it's the fact that there is a pervasive culture of big data.
On the health stuff, though, I thought that was governed by laws already, by the HIPAA laws.
It is, except on the internet. So it is, except, you know, so it's called HIPAA, and those things, if you go to a doctor, you go to a hospital, it's all governed that way. But if you have a health or wellness app, you know, all these things came after those laws were passed, and so they aren't included in the law, and these guys have simply said, we're going to pretend that the law doesn't apply to us. And obviously should apply to that. And that's why I'm out doing this, okay? I'm not doing this because I don't like these guys. I think Mark Zuckerberg is one of the smartest, coolest people I ever knew. I think Sheryl Sandberg is amazing. You know, I think Larry and Sergey from Google are amazing. I think the people who created LinkedIn are amazing. But I do think that we lived in a world that had no rules for a while, and these are really smart people, and they took advantage of that. And I just think, okay, their success is amazing. However, there is all of this stuff we're not aware of that if we were aware of, we would not be happy about it. And I just want to go around and have that conversation.
Roger McNamee is going to be appearing as part of the Town Hall series. He'll be up at the Summit on Pike, which is on Capitol Hill, tomorrow at 7:30 in the evening. Great to talk to you, Roger. Thank you.
Dave, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it, and I can't wait to be in Seattle.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen playground blessed by an unusual variety of natural attraction. The towering mountains.
It's time for All Over the Map. Historian Felix Bunnell with a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places, and in this case, the name of our league-leading team with the best record in baseball, the 3-0 Seattle Mariners.
Yeah, you know, I was just 7 years old, but I remember vividly when word came that Seattle had named its new Major League Baseball franchise. It was late August 1976. People were excited that baseball was coming back, and it was a heady time in general for local big league sports. I mean, just look at the list here. The Seattle Sounders of the North American Soccer League. They were 2 years old, just moved from Memorial Stadium to the New Kingdom. They were named for a geographic feature. The Seattle Supersonics had made it to the NBA playoffs for the first time the previous spring of 75 and again for the second time in 76. They were named for a failed Boeing jetliner, of course.
Right.
Then the Seattle Seahawks were completely new. They were just a few days away from their first ever NFL preseason victory in that same shiny New Kingdom. And they were named for a mythical seabird or an osprey. You see where I'm going here with the alliterative sibilance here?
Yes.
So it was a little hard on the ears to some that the new baseball team's name also didn't start with an S. But as they often do, people had their stages of grief with denial and then acceptance, ultimately. Then where did the Seattle Mariners name come from? Well, of course, there was a contest, just like the Sonics, the Sounders, and the Seahawks did before, and maybe how the new NHL team will be named. A winner of the contest was a guy named Roger Zmodis of Bellevue. He wasn't the only one who suggested the Mariners' name for the city's obvious connections to the sea and the maritime industry, but his essay was deemed the best by the committee. For a prize, Mr. Zmodis got two season tickets for 77 and a trip to see a road game. Now, some of the other names that were talked about with varying degrees of seriousness that spring and summer included the Sovereigns.
The Sovereigns.
The Utopians.
Might be appropriate.
Yeah. Another mythical creature.
Yeah.
The worst one, I think, was the SeaTacs, the Seattle SeaTacs, which doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And then a local columnist was pushing the Totems, which was the name of the hockey team that had failed the year before, kind of a tribute. Kind of bizarre. Now, about the contest, when the team was a replacement for the Seattle Pilots, right? This is
right.
the one season wonder we had here in 1969 that became the Milwaukee Brewers. When it was first announced in February 76 that a team was headed here, one of the main investors was entertainer Danny Kaye. You remember him.
Yes, I do.
The pellet with the poisons in the vessel with the pestle, the chalice from the palace has the true that is brew. Brew that is true.
Yes.
Yeah, so he was a pretty irreverent guy. So at this press conference they had in Seattle on February 7th, 1976, Kaye was in a typically goofy mood. First he said that it was a fatal accomplice that baseball was coming back to Seattle. And when he was questioned about what the team would be called, Mr. Kaye answered with quite irreverently, I wish I had this on tape, but he said, quote, we'll have a great big public thing, meaning a contest, and then we'll pick Rainiers, unquote. So it, almost like it was a rigged witch hunt that we were going to call the team the Rainiers. That was the name of Seattle's previously most successful baseball team, where Fred Hutchinson was a pitcher in the Pacific Coast League and everything. That team had been owned by Emil Sick, who also owned Rainier Beer. It's the ultimate product placement many years before that term was even invented.
Yep.
And, of course, the Mariners in Major League Baseball, that wasn't the first Mariners around here. We had the Seahome High School Mariners back in the 1960s. And then from 74 to 77, San Diego had a world hockey team called the San Diego Mariners. So that's, in a nutshell, that's where we got
there
the name Seattle Mariners.
Well, it's better than the Utopians.
I think we can all agree on that.
Felix Bonnell, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. A new species of killer whale has been discovered and even sighted now off the coast of Chile. Dr. Bob Pittman, who works at the NOAA Research Lab in San Diego, it took 14 years to track these down?
It did, but it actually started back in 1955. There was a stranding of 17 killer whales in New Zealand, and they were very peculiar-looking killer whales. They were quite small. They had very rounded heads, and they had very tiny eye patches. Maybe this was a genetic anomaly. Maybe it was just an extremely rare form of killer whale, or maybe they went extinct. But we didn't hear or see anything related for the next 50 years. And then I went to a killer whale meeting in Seattle in 2005, and a researcher from the Crozet Islands in the South Indian Ocean showed me a picture of a peculiar-looking whale, a group of them, actually, and he said, what do you think of this? And there they were, the New Zealand whales. They had the round heads and the little eye patch, and I nearly fell over. It was.
And so tell me about the ones that you you saw off southern Chile.
Well, I have been looking for these ever since. I've made dozens of trips to Antarctica, and another colleague of mine that was working off of Chile told me that the fishermen had been reporting seeing some of these down there. Now I had a place to go look for them. I got a boat to do it with. The weather is just so bad down there off Cape Horn. We figure if we had 3 weeks, we might get a day or two to go out there and see these things. And in fact, at one time we spent 8 days at anchor while the wind blew 40, 50 knots, and we're beginning to wonder if we're going to get out there.
And you finally saw them.
We got up one morning. The weather was still pretty bad, but we said we got to get out there. And 5:50 in the morning, we had a group up come right over to the boat.
Wow.
And
like they wanted to be discovered?
That's kind of the way it was. They turned around, came right over the boat, and they spent the next 3 hours right there with us. And on reflection, we sort of realized that, you know, they feed quite a bit around fishing boats. So having a boat around is usually good for them. They were quite curious about us. They were a little disappointed, but we weren't.
Just like the seagulls tend to follow the ferries, huh?
That's it. Exactly.
All right. So what makes these killer whales different from the orcas we're familiar with up here in Seattle?
Well, they live out in deep water in some of the nastiest weather in the world, and they are probably much deeper diving than regular killer whales. And they probably have to rely on acoustics more. They're hunting in the dark quite a bit. And I think that that's why they have a rounded head. They have a big melon for projecting the acoustics when they're hunting.
Do you learn anything from this that would help us understand how to restore our own local orca population up here?
You know, it's interesting. Killer whales have kind of diverged into mammal-eating types and fish-eating types. And we protect marine mammals these days. And what that means is those mammal-eating populations of killer whales generally are increasing or doing rather well around the world. But those fish-eating killer whales everywhere are having problems because we compete with them and we take more fish all the time.
So this is a matter of making more fish available. That's what it boils down to.
Yeah, and it's understanding how much fish these populations need. You know, that needs to be part of the equation when we do our management.
So what is a typical meal for a killer whale on a daily basis?
They eat 15% of their body weight. So, I mean, they're eating hundreds and hundreds of pounds. It takes a lot to feed a family of killer whales.
Wow, yeah. Are you thinking the fishermen would tolerate the level of regulation that would be required to free up that amount of fish?
I think most fishermen realize if you don't regulate fisheries, then you end up depleting the stocks and everybody loses. So,
But in other words, there's really no, you can't just go around dumping fish into the water. You have to have some kind of overall regulation that leaves enough for them to eat.
Yeah, feeding wild populations of killer whales is never going to be viable anyway. You just have to see how big your population is and make sure that there's enough there.
So what is the next elusive marine mammal you'll be searching for, Bob?
Well, I'm probably going to continue searching for more of these type D killer whales. I've spent a total of 3 hours with them now, and we would like to learn more about them. Because they live out in the open ocean, we'd like to put some dive depth tags on them to see how deep they can go. My guess is they probably dive deeper than any other killer whales that have been documented before. So, and we'd like to collect some acoustic recordings, because then we could listen for them in those rough waters instead of trying to find them visually. So we got a fair amount more to do with these type D killer whales.
Dr. Bob Pittman is at the NOAA office in San Diego. Bob, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Careful. Watch your head. There goes another one. Yes, it's live-action remakes on Parade.
Cairo film critic Tom Tangney is here with our Friday film review, Disney's new version of Dumbo.
Yeah, Dave, I don't know if you realize that Dumbo is the first of three live-action Disney remakes that are going to hit theaters in the next 4 months. I mean, so we're going to have one right after the other. You've got Aladdin and Lion King. Aladdin, I think, is in May, and Lion King's coming up in July. The original Dumbo was made in 1941, as some of us old folks know. But that
you're makes not that old.
By far, no. By far the oldest source material of all the Disney remakes. And the plot is also the thinnest. Mrs. Jumbo gives birth to Dumbo, a baby elephant with ridiculously floppy ears. She's banished from the circus for trying to protect him. Dumbo is really sad until he realizes he can fly with those floppy ears. And after successfully flying in a circus act, he's reunited with his mom. Now, Dumbo, even with that plot, stretched to a mere 64 minutes back then, and that included the hallucinatory five-minute Pink Elephants on Parade sequence, which we were just listening to as we started this review, which was brilliantly animated but entirely unnecessary to advance the story. So, one of the biggest hurdles facing a live-action remake is expanding an already thin hour-long storyline to double its length without losing story momentum. And that's not an easy task. This remake decides to introduce a cast of humans almost entirely missing from the original. Colin Farrell plays Holt, a circus stunt rider who returns from World War I with only one arm. He reunites with his two kids, who are still mourning the loss of their mother, who recently died from influenza. And if that isn't enough bad news for any Disney movie, the circus itself is on its last legs financially. Its last best hope is that the soon-to-be-born baby elephant is a hit at the box office. After Dumbo is born, to much ridicule and his mother banished, it's up to Holt's kids to save him.
What's happening? Where are they taking her?
Take Dumbo back inside.
But she's his mom. Do something. She needs us. Look at me. We're going to bring your mama home.
Clearly identifying with Dumbo because
they resist that.
Exactly. They've too lost their mom. The two kids do all they can to cheer up the baby elephant and end up inadvertently teaching it how to fly. The psychological connection between Dumbo and the kids is a legitimate extension of the fairy tale of a story. Although the animal characters that they replaced from the original, Timothy Mouse and the Five Black Crows, are definitely livelier as characters. The other storyline expansion involves an entertainment mogul played very broadly, maybe too broadly, by Michael Keaton, who, after seeing the amazing Dumbo actually fly, buys out the entire circus and ships them to his behemoth amusement park called Dreamland.
Another evil capitalist.
Exactly. And a lot of people say a stand-in for Disney himself, Walt Disney. He, of course, is up to no good, Dave, and it's up to the circus workers and, of course, Dumbo to save the day. Having more or less adequately cleared the story expansion hurdle, this Dumbo remake also must at least approach, if not match, the emotional strength of the original. Even non-fans of the 41 version acknowledge the emotional power of the mother-child bond depicted in the film, especially during the baby mind song, when Mrs. Jumbo is locked up and Dumbo's only contact with her is a trunk to trunk through the bars of a hard to reach window.
Rest your hand close to my heart, never to part, baby of mine.
Now, despite the fact that Tim Burton is this remake's director and he's known more for his visual flair than his emotional sensitivity, this baby mind sequence especially is expertly handled. Perhaps not as tear-inducing as the original, which splices in a lot of other zoo animals cuddling with their offspring, much like Dumbo and Mom are trying to do. The Burton version is still quite touching and sweet, and much of that credit goes to the brilliant CGI work with Dumbo itself. He's so convincingly rendered that you'll forget he's not real halfway through the movie, and that makes his ability to fly all the more amazing. Hey, look at that elephant fly. We're just like the people in the audience.
You can believe it. I saw some of the, I've seen the trailer, and yeah, you think it's aerodynamically possible.
There you go. And I will credit Burton and his screenwriter with one solid improvement to the original. Stirring is not an adjective I would ever think to apply to Dumbo, but it's definitely applicable a couple of times in the remake. The two circus scenes in which Dumbo actually flies under the big top are dramatic and thrilling to see. Burton builds the suspense, disaster is definitely looming, and then with a sudden swooping of elephant ears and a whoosh of relief, Dumbo is spectacularly flying and in the most triumphant fashion. In fact, Burton's Dumbo is given real agency as he even takes part in his own and his mother's rescue. In the end, Dumbo not only owns his outsized ears and revels in them, as he does in the original, he also uses them to help himself and others. In this remake, Dumbo is his own hero, and that's quite an accomplishment.
So how many tangs for Dumbo?
I give it 3 tangs out of 4, Dave.
Thank you, Tom.
And you can catch my review at MyNorthwest.com, as usual.
Your daily dose of kindness now. Gonzaga has advanced to the Elite Eight. They're going to take on Texas Tech University, a team which, if successful, would head to its first Final Four in the history of the program. Most of us as Washingtonians will be rooting for Gonzaga. But there's a heartwarming story behind the success of Texas Tech. Perhaps it was this that propelled them to the Elite Eight. KCBD reports the team's coach has a knack for surprising his players. Earlier this month, he flew the family of Brandon Francis in from the Dominican Republic. His mother hadn't seen him in 2 years. She'd never seen him play for this team. It was a really nice surprise. And then for the Sweet 16 game, the coach again surprised another player, flying the family of David Moretti in from Italy. He began the surprise by talking to his team about who they play for.
Tonight you need to be getting yourself ready to play and getting the guy next to you ready to play, okay? Moore, I want you to stand up in front of everybody here and tell us who you're playing for tomorrow.
Play for everybody. in this room and for my family. Oh my gosh.
Stood up, said, I'm going to play for everyone on this team. Going to play for my family. And that's what he saw his family in the back there coming out. Hugs, tears, all that good stuff. So maybe that worked, and that's why they're headed to the Elite Eight. We still have to root against you, though. Sorry, man. Gonzaga's got to get to the Final Four.
Yeah. Did pretty well. Looked pretty good yesterday.
Yeah.
And now, the Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And on loan this morning from the Brock and Salk Show, it's James Osborne. That was a ball game.
Back she goes, going. Goodbye, baseball. Underneath the out-of-town scoreboard, Tim Beckham with his second home run of the season.
And that was just the fifth Mariners home run of the game. So, was I supposed to know who Tim Beckham was? I always ask Danny, you know, which name should I try to memorize, and I don't remember his.
Yeah, that's okay if you don't remember his. He was at one point the number one overall pick in baseball out of high school in 2011 with the Tampa Bay Rays, and he hasn't been great since. He was a free agent from Baltimore. They signed him to a two-year deal, I believe, pretty low money. So he was sort of expected to be a stopgap kind of guy until J.P. Crawford, their shortstop of the future, comes up. So it's okay that you don't know who Tim Beckham is.
Well, but where did he come from? I mean, they played the Boston Red Sox and won 12-4.
Yeah, any time that you're drafted number one overall in a sport, you are projected to have insane talent. And a lot of times when guys are drafted out of high school, that's raw talent. It's potential. It's something they expect to see someday in the future. For Tim Beckham, he was never really able to put all of those things together. The five tools, hitting, running, power, contact, all that stuff. He was never really able to fully realize all of that stuff from an 18-year-old to what he is now, I think 27. So now that he's maybe in a more soft landing spot, the expectations are gone, that you don't even know his name is probably one of the reasons why he has no expectations. And he could sort of cut loose with a chip on his shoulder to say, I'm out to prove myself, to prove that I am worthy of being picked number one overall, and that I still have a place in this league. So it was exciting to watch him get off to a hot start.
I've already been warned not to get too excited, which I sort of take offense to, because this was an exciting game. Five homers. We beat the World Series champions. How dare you tell me not to get excited? But you know, what is this? Is this the team gelling? Is it opening day excitement? What was it last night?
Something we see in sports more often now, I think, than even a decade ago, is teams who are really excited about playing against expectations. When people doubt them, they love to prove people wrong.
A la Seahawks.
Exactly. Yeah. We got a first row seat to that in 2013 and 14. So I think there's a little bit of that going on with this Mariners team. Baseball is a little tougher to keep that going for a long period of time because you've got 162 chances
right.
to prove people wrong.
Yeah.
And eventually the monotony of the sport kind of bears out talent in a lot of ways. So we could see a good run here for a while, and we could see some good stretches of baseball. It's a talented team. It's just sort of a shallow team, and it's got some major holes in it.
And do we like the new hot pink glow of the stadium?
Magenta. It's magenta.
Oh, is that what it is?
It's very important.
We
call it
magenta.
No, because it's not hot pink. It's magenta. It's T-Mobile magenta. It's
it
very important.
To me.
It's the magenta meadow, is what I call it.
Is it?
We get to see Yusei Kikuchi tonight. This will be his first game in Seattle?
Yeah, second game in the majors. A lot of prospect rankings that I've seen have put him in the top 50 prospects in baseball. Obviously, he's older. He's a well-established pitcher in Japan. But that's exciting. That was something that kind of came out of nowhere for the Mariners. So now to see him start to actualize some of that potential really right away, it gets you excited about what could be in the next couple of years. If he is truly the talent they think he is, he could be one of those pieces at the top of the rotation, which are the hardest things to get in baseball.
Yeah. Should we move on to basketball?
Ooh. How about those Zags?
How about those Zags?
Yeah.
The game started off a little bit slow. I was switching back and forth between the Mariners and the Zags.
You spent your evening watching sports, not C-SPAN?
I did, yes.
Wow.
I'd seen enough of C-SPAN for a while. Yeah, the Michael Cohen hearing just did it for me.
That's right, yeah.
Anyway, so
cup runneth over.
Yeah, so I was switching back and forth, and that at times that was an amazingly fast game. I'm just curious, when they do that razzle dazzle stuff, like they throw it up to the basket and there's like two guys there ready to dunk it in, or they throw to one guy across to the other and then it turns out magically somebody appears under the basket and do they rehearse those things, or does that all just develop spontaneously?
There's a lot of natural talent, but I think when you talk about offensive designs of good teams. A lot of times those coaches do a great job of putting their players in a general position to be in the right spot to capitalize on an opportunity. And then when you have the right kind of body type and talent to fill that role in an offense, it makes it look like it's so simple, like they're not even trying, they're not even thinking, they're just reacting. In reality, there's a good mix of both, and there is a lot of planning and executing the offense to get those players in position to be there for an alley-oop when it's like, wow, I don't see anyone else doing this kind of stuff, but these guys do. Or be ready for a kick-out three with two passes. That's the kind of stuff you see in the NBA a lot. So I think there's a good mix of both. And this team has a lot of height, a lot of length, a lot of talent all the way through, and they've got probably four guys who could win a game for you just based on their sheer talent alone. It's an exciting team.
The way they were able to nail those three-pointers just continues to amaze me. And is what is can you give me a little insight on that? What's the secret to that? Does the guy who does – because I noticed that nobody actually runs to the line and then tries the three-pointer. The guy's been standing there for a while. And is he standing there trying to, you know, judge his shot? Or why is it that you can only do it from a standing position rather than just running?
Yeah, you would think so. What you would call a good three-point shot or a good set shot, you've got your body lined up in a specific way, and you've got your sort of muscles all sort of, I guess, coiled and ready to make that shot in that specific way, and you've practiced it that over and over. Yeah. When you're moving, just the physics of it change a lot, right? How far you have to shoot, how much muscle you have to use, where the ball is going to go after you release it.
So there's kind of a tell when you see a guy sort of move into that position, just sort of stand there right by the three-point line so that you, when you just automatically go to him and start waving your arms in front of him?
It is, but that's where the five-man sport of basketball gets interesting, because if you just try and stay on that guy the whole time, inevitably you're going to let somebody come closer to the basket with a higher percentage shot, so you cheat on the backside to help out.
Deliberately, if he's a good enough actor, he could deliberately plant himself there and distract you.
Yeah, that's why the NBA is not that fun to watch. Because every team has like four guys on that team that can stand in one spot, and then there's one talented guy to run to the rim and pass it out.
Is this your next goal, is a flawless three-pointer after that first pitch, Dave?
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
No, don't even bring
that up. I'm not kidding you. It was a great first pitch. Now you got to sing some three-pointers.
Yeah, that's right. No, that'll be my next line.
I'm the Steph Curry of Seattle's Morning News.
Minus about 4 feet. James Osborne, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
And this is Seattle's Morning News, Friday morning. Should the statute of limitations for sexual assault be extended? Legislature's talking about just that issue right now, and Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott is here. So where does it stand now?
So there's two bills that are still working their way through the legislature. One is in the Senate, the other in the House. Both would eliminate the statute of limitations for 8 sex crimes involving victims 16 and under, including rape, molestation, and exploitation. It also extends the statute of limitations for other sex crimes, most other sex crimes for adults and kids, to 20 years. Representative Dan Griffey has been fighting for this to get done for years, sharing his very personal experience of his wife, who was sexually abused as a child, but who the statute of limitations ran out on, and then 20 years later, a daughter who survived a horrific attack.
Our daughter was raped and left for dead in Anchorage, Alaska. And the pain that I felt was terrible, but the pain and the shame that my wife felt by thinking that she didn't do enough to protect our daughter, we'll never get over in our family.
And he knows just how hard it can be for sexual assault survivors to come forward. He had to push his daughter to go to the police. By the time she finally did, it was too late. Griffey says the change is vitally important for all sexual assault survivors. And Senator Monka Dhingra agrees. She's behind the Senate version of this bill and says as a King County prosecutor for years, she's seen the need for the change firsthand.
It recognizes the science of trauma and how trauma is addressed by survivors and makes sure that we are making our laws consistent with the science of trauma and disclosure when people feel comfortable talking about what has happened to them.
And that can take years for sexual assault survivors, especially when you're talking about kids. And here's why that matters.
We also know historically that perpetrators who target minors tends to repeat that behavior over and over again. And because we're dealing with such vulnerable victims, we do want to make sure that whenever they're in a space where they can talk about their abuse, they still have the ability to do so. And it really is an attempt to make sure we are going after the serial pedophiles.
This has been proposed for going on 4 years now, and this is the farthest it's ever got. But now there's talk of an amendment being added to the bill that some worry will derail it. The amendment would eliminate the statute of limitations for adult offenders, but not for underage offenders. It's an issue that Representative Nicole Frame raised earlier in the session.
If we raise the statute of limitations for those who are juveniles when they commit offenses, and they are brought to term for their crime, they're held accountable for their crime when they're 40, 50, 60 years old, what do we do with a 60-year-old who's being prosecuted for a crime they committed when they were 14, 15 years old?
Now, I want to point out, this is not a retroactive bill, so this would only apply to crimes
going forward.
Yeah. But at a committee hearing yesterday on one of the bills, women's rights attorney David Ward with Legal Voice said this is not the bill to address that amendment issue that Nicole Frame was just talking about.
I think that can be part of a discussion in another context, because there are other crimes where that happens too, homicide, arson. And if there's going to be a solution to that issue that the legislature wants to consider, please take that up outside of the context of this bill and move this bill this year, because it really is so critical for survivors.
And sexual assault survivor Leah Griffin says adding the amendment to protect juvenile offenders sends the absolute wrong message to the victims.
This is already one of the most, or the most, unreported crimes, because people are afraid that they're not going to, that their stories don't matter. And adding an amendment like this confirms that to victims whose rapists are under 18. It basically says we, as a society, care more about the future of the person that assaulted you than we care about your future and ability to get justice.
As far as Senator Dingra is concerned,
this bill is not about addressing consequences to the rapist. This bill is about ensuring that survivors have a voice. We have seen this over and over again, where institutions of power are more concerned about the consequences to the rapist. And so my message here is very clear. This is about giving survivors a voice, about updating our statute of limitations so they're consistent with science, period.
So right now, both of the bills are still working their way through. It's kind of a behind-the-scenes chatter that there's some members thinking about this amendment and a lot of pushback right now from some survivors and others trying to make sure that doesn't happen.
Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.